Welcome to the San Diego Psychological Association's podcast, Diving into Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Carcel. This podcast has been developed with the intent to inform and educate the general public and providers and should not be relied upon for any other purpose. The content, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker and not those of the San Diego Psychological Association. Today's show is on the invisible epidemic of chronic pain and childhood trauma. Welcome, Tracy Chester, and thank you for being on the show.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much. I've been really looking forward to bringing some awareness to this epidemic.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of times when I think about and we talk about trauma, you know, a lot of people that I converse with think about like the big T trauma. And what I mean by that is we think about injury or domestic violence. We think about things that, you know, we see on the news, but we don't think about the small T, little T traumas, which are things that we live with every single day, experiences that we've gone through. And I think let's go ahead and jump in because this is a really big topic. And I wanted to start with, for you, how did you get interested in this? This is personal for you, isn't it?
It's very personal. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is my second career. Before this, I was a geologist, and I got weeded out from having severe reactions when I would travel to different time zones. And I eventually left that career, had my children, but I had suffered some of these extreme symptoms that I couldn't explain. Back when I was 20, there wasn't much, you know, about anxiety and depression on TV. I didn't even know what it was, believe it or not. So I left the profession and wanted to get into psychology. So I, as my kids were growing up, I became a therapist. So I have like 13 years of therapy experience at this point, but it took me like 8 years to get licensed because while that was happening, after my children were born, I started to experience chronic pain myself. I already had, you know, the mental health part kind of understanding that that was what was going on, but it was still very new. But this pain part was very difficult. And that experience just led me to try to help others. And in trying to help others, I started to see different experiences than I had. I went through hell, but I was treated very well by doctors. I navigated the medical system pretty well. And even with that, it took 15 something years. And so now I was seeing patients and clients who could not get good care, and I didn't understand. So finally, I realized, hey, I need to be talking to their doctors. And this trauma, as we think of in the psychological sense, that's just coming up now. I didn't even know about trauma 4 years ago. And doctors are just now learning about it. But so when you're at the doctor's office, they have no idea what's going on. And meanwhile, you're hearing, well, your anxiety, when you get anxiety, you get worse. So you kind of understand all these things, but you don't know why. And I just eventually ended up partnering with a pain doctor. Finally, somebody saw the vision. And in the office, I could see these patients, they acted differently in appointments and how they were treated. So, you know, I got very interested in medical trauma, obviously, because that's what I was going through. And once I learned about the childhood trauma and how it affects our system and where that link came, in hindsight, I can see what was going on. I don't know how I would have reacted at the time if I'd understood that. I certainly hope I would have had less shame.
Yeah. Wow. Your story is so compelling. And I imagine, you know, there's so many people that experience this as well. It is an invisible epidemic. You know, one of the things when it comes to chronic pain is that so many people actually do suffer from it. And I think it's important that we, you know, start out by, you know, defining some of these things. So that way, you know, folks who are listening, they can kind of resonate, see what comes up for them as we're talking about it. I think the first that's important to start with is, what is chronic pain? How would you define that?
Chronic pain is basically pain that persists longer than what, say, the original injury or illness, the recovery time you would expect. Mm-hmm. And it can come after an injury, or it can come sort of out of nowhere. It's at some point you may start developing, you know, symptoms like interstitial cystitis and colitis, irritable bowel, some of these things. You may just suddenly get these things from out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And it can feel like it's not an injury and you don't know what's going on. And there's a lot of confusion.
Yes, there can be. And the connection, I know I spoke a little bit earlier about trauma. I definitely want to open up that platform because, like I said, I think there's a huge misconception about, you know, what trauma actually is and people minimizing what trauma is for themselves. So I'm curious, how do you define trauma? I know I kind of mentioned big T trauma, the big stuff that we see on TV or we think about in the news versus, you know, day-to-day stuff, you know, whether it's an argument or something that shapes us or hurts us or even, you know, childhood memories of abuse, bullying, things that are big, but that we might minimize. I'm curious for you, how do you encompass or think about trauma?
Well, exactly that. The big T trauma, as we use in our language, is, you know, I see soldiers and they come in and they have PTSD and it's because of this. But what I found out through working with them was when I give them this this one test called the Adverse Childhood Experience Test, known as the ACE test. When I would give them this test, it would list 10 things that would happen in childhood that were pretty obvious, like you said, bullying, sexual abuse. But there's also little T's that can be just a perfectionist mom who's criticizing you through childhood. And you're always kind of on guard. Like she always manages to break you or criticize you. And it can be repetitive. So that can be the minimum. And then you can have like severe getting beat up. I've had patients that have 8 out of 10 on that scale that their pain is out of control because when you're doing these repetitive, experiencing the repetitive trauma, and by the way, trauma is not the thing that happens. Trauma is how we experience something, right? I mean, we all know two people can see the same thing and one could be, you know, anxious and depressed and unable to function and the other could, you know, go home and take a few days and just carry on. Everyone has a different tolerance, basically. So this repetitiveness sets up what we call little T trauma, but it's the same mechanism of what do you need to do to survive?
Right.
What do you need to do to survive? So in those extreme things like being beat up, you have to hide in the closet per se.
Right.
And you get very, you know, you're always on guard. And later in life, you're still having that experience despite that not occurring anymore.
Right.
And what's interesting and common is for those of us who now understand it was childhood trauma, usually we didn't, that word sounded too severe and we didn't count it because we were looking at it through an adult lens. Like, oh yeah, yeah, I had this going on. But that has nothing to do with what's going on now. So, you know, it's very important to educate on this.
Yes, I agree completely. And I love that we're segueing this into the core of what a lot of the somatic symptoms or physical symptoms that people experience, you know, they can manifest because of holding in these childhood traumatic experiences. I wonder what you think about this. I often think about, you know, our society and how we kind of have set ourselves up has been more of a medical model in that, oh, something hurts, let's take a pill for it or go to the doctor and kind of, you know, fix it that way versus a combination approach where we actually look at, hey, am I stressed? Am I anxious? Am I sad? Am I depressed? And what is that doing to me physically? And can we do both? Can we look at both my mental health state and my physical state? I don't feel like that approach is very common. I'm curious what you think.
It's not. And if you think about the fundamental of trauma, trauma is survival, fight, flight, freeze. These manifest right. physically. There's research I've seen, and this is very advanced, so I won't go into too much, but people's posture can reflect what they've experienced. People are literally bent over in shame, and that often turns into depression. But let's go back to what's happening. We're sensing a threat, small or large. Our sympathetic nervous system activates. And what happens? You're getting ready. So your heart rate increases, your bronchial passages open. You actually decrease the ability to have movement in your bowels. It skips like, okay, we're not going anywhere. Pupil dilation. And then you add to that sort of that, you know, anxiety of what's going on. But what's happened is this sympathetic nervous system has taken over. And the thing where I find this the most interesting is that, sorry to talk about the bowels, but this is a very vulnerable part of us. And I noticed when you talk about the SNS, I'm just going to call it that now for now, because I can't stand saying that over and over.
Sure.
But that the intestines freeze when, and then when you engage what we call the parasympathetic nervous system, which is what we want to relax, to get out of this trauma. This is the basis of all trauma therapy, our resting and digesting. So if you think about something like ulcerative colitis, we have a big epidemic of this. And now you think about that, it's like, oh, is there something to that? Like sometimes people are constipated, sometimes, you know, and when you look at the way the body reacts under trauma, it's kind of a piece of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think we're learning more and more every day. The advancements of being able to test and see people's responses now in a mental health setting and how the body responds, there truly is a mind-body connection. I mean, it just makes sense, right? We're encompassing all of these facets within one mind, one body. So how the body takes in the information of trauma experiences will manifest in some way physically. And the other part that I really like that you brought up earlier was, you know, to simplify for myself, is attachment. You know, how we're raised and these experiences, if we have a strong attachment to our caregivers and we have a good support group, our window of tolerance of experiences, meaning that ability to hold these harder things, is bigger because we have a good support system. We have, you know, a healthy mindset. We're able to take in these experiences and tolerate them a little bit better. However, for people suffering with insecure attachments and they don't have that support system, or their primary, you know, caregivers or people in their lives are the ones causing this abuse, they're not going to know how to cope. They're not going to know how to deal with these feelings. And a lot of times they can internalize this as, it must be me. Like, I'm the reason, like, a lot of this is happening. And then we see that chronic pain piece of it, where I know Dr. Levine, Peter Levine, talks about this and somatic processing, and it's a really great resource and research that he's done. But we see this across the board now. We're seeing more of this. And I'd love your feedback, because this is your area of expertise. Can you elaborate a little bit on what patterns you tend to notice when you're working with someone who's a chronic pain patient?
Well, let me start by talking about what you were mentioning, which is...
Yes, please.
Attachment. So adverse childhood events are events that happen in childhood. When you talk about 0 to 3 years old, sometimes 0 to 6 years old, that's a particularly important time in our brain development. Our reward systems become wired. Like you said, if you have a caregiver there to hug you, we get a little boost. We don't have that, we don't. And so they actually call it complex developmental trauma. And my example of this is myself. I had a sister who was very ill when she was born. And my parents believed she was going to pass away. And so they made this decision to have another child, which was me. So while I was in utero, even, my mother has a dying child. Imagine what she's going through. Imagine what's going on in her nervous system. This is all getting transmitted, right? My tolerance, even coming out of the womb, is already kind of like, oh, I can't take much. Then I was born and she did survive. So I lived in this house between 0 and 3. A child was dying. And that's a house of dread. And when we talk about trauma, we're talking about pre-verbal feelings of, there's dread and we can't really process it. A lot of people think young children are immune to trauma, but it's not. They're actually worse. They're being immersed into this. And so these feelings of doom and gloom and anxiety were just programmed into me. What it does is it sets up your nervous system, okay? And when you do experience injury later or illness, your body's just ready to jump right at it. And like you say, the window of tolerance is physical as well as emotional. And so physical and emotional are basically the same. Everything gets lit up and they show damage to areas of the brain from trauma. And we can see it's both emotional and physical. The problem comes when you don't really understand why you have chronic pain and you start seeing doctors and they can't figure it out. And doctors want to figure this out, but these patients are complex. It took me 15 years to really get to the underlying thing. And I did also, I mean, in fact, have injuries too and surgeries. So it was very easy to say, oh, this surgery caused this pain I still have, and it's still causing it. And that may be, we can never eliminate that. When patients come to me, they've typically been, I mean, some I hope are not as long as me, but typically 5 or 6 years into their illness, and they have become their own experts. But when they go into a doctor's office, say, this is a person in early childhood who had an abusive father or a critical father, and the doctor kind of questions you, he only has 10 minutes, and you may come in already feeling ashamed because your attachment was so bad as a child, that add on to what I experienced as a mother who was critical, who blamed and shamed. I didn't even have the fundamental access to anger. Everything was my fault. So these patients come in, they're experts, and they're dismissed by family, by doctors, by friends. And the pain is real. Let me just state that. Pain is real and it deserves to be treated. And I know we're going to talk about this later. Sometimes that does involve opioids. That is kind of a touchy subject.
Yeah.
But it's a more nuanced conversation. That is probably for another time.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely agree that we can discuss, you know, treatment. We could discuss it definitely here, and I think we should. You know, one of the things that I want to stick with, first of all, thank you so much for sharing your story. That is very difficult, and I'm glad you're, you know, willing to bring in the reality of your experiences, because a lot of people listening probably have similar experiences where they have had, you know, moments where they've been dismissed or they don't have, again, that security of upbringing. And I want to define for people who may not, you know, because we're using terms here, I want to make sure that it's defined a little bit. But when we say window of tolerance, what we're talking about is really the person's ability to hold the traumas or the experiences and do it effectively, where you're still able to function, where you're able to feel, you know, okay, I'm hurting, I can cry. I'm you know, needing to reach out to friends and family for support, I can do that. I need to take self-care time, I'm going to do that. And that you're able to hold the space of pain from either past experiences and trauma or present, and you're able to function well with it. That's essentially what we mean with window of tolerance. But
I have a good, not to interrupt, but I have a way that I explain it to my clients and patients, which is think about your tolerance to spice when you're talking about a window of tolerance.
Nice. Yes.
I literally, because of my childhood, I have like zero tolerance. I can taste multiple layers in bread, like white bread, that other people don't. And then you have somebody who can swallow a jalapeno and be fine. So just apply that somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And it's not my fault that I have zero tolerance. I'm not judging myself.
Right.
You know, that, oh God, I can't handle pepper. I'm a weak person.
Right.
If you can get that perspective on yourself in other areas that you're not a weak person, this is just,
yes.
When you have childhood issues, it damages your brain. I don't mean that in a bad way, but it is a form of brain damage. It is a form of your brain becoming hyper-vigilant constantly in this trauma phase, even as adults when we don't need it.
Correct. Yes. I often refer to it as rewired. It's your brain is completely rewired. Yeah. And, you know, we end up staying stuck in sympathetic mode where that's where anxiety lives. So a lot of times when I talk to people with significant childhood trauma, I'm sure you've experienced this too, it's hard because I'm always anxious, and mindfulness and these practices that we're trying to teach tend to be very challenging, because that's something that's just foreign. It's not, they're not used to that. And self-compassion and some of these practices also are something that can be a little foreign. So I'm so glad that, you know, we're opening this conversation up to the connection between, you know, trauma and childhood experiences with pain and chronic pain. So I want to go back for a second, and I think it'd be helpful to talk a little bit about, you know, someone who might be listening who's not sure, you know, they're not maybe sure about the distinction between what they're experiencing, or they've gone to the doctor and the doctor's like, you know, we're not finding anything on your test. I hear that a lot from people with chronic pain. I'm not seeing anything on your test. You seem to be okay. And they feel so lost. I guess maybe it'd be helpful to go back to my original question earlier. You know, what do you notice when you're working with someone with chronic pain? Like, what are some symptoms that, you know, that might be able to help someone who's going through this?
Well, I mean, one of the biggest symptoms is feelings of being a burden. I want to really make this distinct. There's pain and there's suffering. And this is the connection between emotional and physical. Somebody can feel a pain and they're okay with it. They're not suffering from it. I kind of wonder with my dog, because my dog hurt his eye. I don't see the dog suffering. Like, maybe they're in pain and they don't think about it, right? So suffering is what happens to us emotionally, and physically we suffer as well. So we're going to have all of those, anxiety, depression, all of those terms that most people are familiar with. But what we're also experience is we're a burden. We're a burden on our families. And often the families don't feel comfortable really saying it. Kind of you are a burden. Because if they say it to us, we're like, oh, yes, of course. And then we feel feelings of stigma, which is really important about chronic pain. People don't believe you. People judge you on what you're eating, drinking, taking. On top of that, add isolation. Isolation is huge. We didn't actually put numbers to this at the beginning, but the chronic pain epidemic is somewhere between 50 and 100 million, depending on what you're talking about. But 50 million Americans, that's 1 in 6, are experiencing chronic illness or chronic pain. It is costing society billions of dollars. It is the underlying cause of most medical issues. Most medical issues are caused by smoking, per se. Why do you smoke? When you were young, you got no attention and you didn't really develop kind of your own reward system. So you looked to something to help you feel better. This is where addiction and trauma overlap. It's not about the substance. It's about the trauma and the need to reach to the substance.
Right. And the maladaptive coping things that we learn because we don't have that guidance, as you referenced, which I think is very accurate. And you're right. The cost of this, of not acknowledging the underlying issues that cause us to have these maladaptive coping, or, you know, the physical responses, the somatic processing of pain, I think is so significant. And I'm glad when you were talking about what do you notice when you're working with someone with chronic pain, that you're bringing up the emotion, you're bringing up burden, you know, feeling shame, feeling guilt, you know, that all of these things have underlying premise, and that the body is acknowledging that. I'll give myself as an example here. When I'm stressed, headache, muscle tension, GI.
Yep.
Done.
Right.
Like, I know I've got, my stomach's not going to feel good. I'm going to have a headache. I'm going to have some back pain. That's when I'm stressed. So acknowledgement of these things is a really, I think, great step, and awareness and education, you know, not only to, you know, the public, but also to providers, because medical models, they just don't teach the mind-body connection as much. I think it's getting better.
It's the work I'm trying to do. But when you get a headache and your neck hurts, it sounds like it does go away.
It can, yes.
Mm-hmm. One of the big things pattern I notice is that as therapists, it's difficult to sit with somebody that's having chronic mm-hmm. pain every day. And we want to offer tools. We want to say, you know, we want to be like a doctor, like, here, take this, it'll help your pain.
Oh, yeah.
But we have no way to help their physical pain. So we try to work on the suffering piece. But let me be clear, the people I see and most pain patients are not adequately treated for their pain. They have not found something that will help. And you can't do much with a person who's still in pain or is still ill. Mm-hmm. I founded this clinic and I worked with someone named Dr. Michelle Sexton, who works with UCSD Pain. She is an expert in botanicals, but she consults about cannabis with pain. I was working with her. I got permission and we could see her records at UCSD, this particular patient. And so I was able to work with the whole thing, and I was able to see behind the scenes what the pain doctors were saying and what was happening. But that happened because of collaboration. And this is the needle that needs to be moved. And I am moving it. I do have the opportunity in October to speak before 1,000 family practice doctors at a meeting in Anaheim because my own doctor, when I started to tell her about all this stuff, she became amazed and hadn't heard of the adverse childhood events and wanted to help. And you know, and she happens to have a huge platform because she's a Team USA doctor. So she's able to, you know, bring my voice up. And that's, you know, and that's hard. A lot of chronic pain patients, we're in this little Facebook group and we all know, but nobody's giving a voice out there. And to be given a platform like from you guys is an honor.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that. And again, I think, you know, the collaboration is essential for any practitioners listening. You know, one of the things that I feel really grateful for is I had a professor, you know, that very much advocated in my graduate program to make sure you're collaborating with the medical providers. Make sure we are reaching out and making those connections. And, you know, sometimes it's better, goes better than others. But, you know, I would say personally, most of the time, I've had wonderful responses from, you know, medical providers who are happy to hear that we're doing the work we're doing with people with chronic pain or people with, you know, variation of trauma, and it's translating in this in a pain process. I personally am really excited to see that this has been so positive and that you're doing what you're doing to get this knowledge and awareness out. That's really exciting. And thank you for doing that. That's great.
You're welcome. You know, and like you say, it's true that I've never met a doctor who didn't want their patient who was difficult to have therapy. But we are just in a different world. And right now, the best they can do is refer you. And that is the level that exists in most places. And there are levels of collaboration defined by people who specialize in addiction, where the optimal thing that you can be in is in a center that has psychiatry, psychology, massage, all of that. That exists in rehab. And to do that, they have collaborated to what they call the sixth level. Everyone's working on everyone. It's all teamwork. There are six levels. We are at level one right now, which is, oh, you need a therapist. When I was doing this until I got this position, the doctors didn't necessarily want to hear from me. And they, you know, they're busy. They have 10 minutes. So what you know, why I want doctors to know about this is that you also have your own trauma. A doctor has his own trauma, or she, and they can react. And so you get a doctor who's very compassionate, and then you get a doctor who's just like, no, I don't hear anything, and I'm going to just detach. So when I have found doctors that will work with me, it's been great. We can target the appointment. I can say, this is what's going on, you know, within reason and without, you know, blowing confidentiality, but, you know, this is what she's really concerned about. And then they can address that and they feel more control and less appointments. You know, the whole thing could be so much better. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I appreciate your advocacy. I feel the same way. And my hope is, as we're talking about this, that, you know, for providers and, you know, patients alike and people who are suffering through this, that, you know, there are ways that we can make it a little easier. And we're really trying. You know, I think most clinicians are trying to make it easier and do a more integrative approach, which is, I think, very, very positive. You know, I wanted to go back to something you were saying. You know, we were talking about, you know, the trauma effects and, of course, the emotional, you know, aspects of this, which, as you were mentioning, shame, feeling like a burden, you know, these are very core, hard feelings. I also wanted to come back to what you were talking about treatment. You know, one of the things when it comes to treatment, we're talking today about a comprehensive approach, both mind, body, but you did also mention, you know, pharmaceuticals. And, you know, I'm personally very interested in novel compound treatment. I think that we're exploring this in a very effective way. Well, what I mean by that is psilocybin, mm-hmm. You know, cannabis is being researched, you know, ketamine. We're seeing these different types of controlled studies that are really producing some fantastic, outcomes. And, you know, you were talking about opiates, and that's kind of the gold standard, isn't it? A little bit. I'm not that familiar with the treatment in this regard for chronic pain, but would you agree, like opiate, you know, prescriptions for pain management and, you know, tell me a little bit about that and what patients can expect, you know, if they're suffering.
Oh, where do I?
Yeah, where do you begin?
So yes, if you talk to any pain doctor, you know, as a peer, even as a, like a patient, they're not all going to not tell you this, but they will tell you that the reason opioids exist is that they're actually the best we have right now. That's all they have. They don't want to prescribe it. If you ask about patterns of my patients, I spend like a lot of time telling them it's okay that you're on medication. What's important is that you're following the pain doctor's guidelines. And things have become kind of draconian in terms of doctors. They're in a difficult position where society is saying there's an opioid crisis. It's not really based on data. And doctors, it's because you're prescribing, and doctors are put in a position where they have to be like the police. So, you know, I would have to go in and give urine samples all the time. And it feels very degrading. Mm. And I saw an episode on John Oliver about the rehab industry, and I couldn't help but notice all the years when I was in pain offices that, you know, first it was fine. And then we started to see, what is opioid dependence? What's this drug? You know, one is called Suboxone. What's that? It turned. They actually wanted people to believe they had opioid addiction. And what was a guideline by the CDC was to primary care doctors, like, hey, that person who's coming in with their knee, maybe you should send them off to pain management. This became misappropriately used. Even the president of the AMA has said so, to the point where people are now being taken off, you know, opioids against their will. And that's a threat to their safety, mm-hmm. if you think about it. If this is all they think is helping them, and sometimes it's a huge part, but it can't work just on its own. But if that's the one thing they believe is helping them, and like I said, that can be, and you say, no, I'm going to take it away, there's new rules. This is like something I'm making up my own diagnosis, which is involuntary weaning anxiety. So anyway, to go back, I'm glad you mentioned all those other things. I actually, in this institute I founded, I work with Dr. Sexton, and we talk about cannabis, and we work together to help patients use cannabis to help with pain and mood. And I do trauma therapy, or one of my clinicians does. I also work with an anesthesiologist, and we have done ketamine therapy for chronic pain. When you have ketamine, is like the extreme answer for somebody who's in so much pain, there's nothing we can do. And it works in a similar fashion to some of these psychedelics you're talking about. Psychedelics have a difference, though. They grow brain and reconnect. These other things, ketamine, MMDA, don't exactly have that effect. Their effect is more on what we call the glutamate system, and I can't explain it. I don't understand brain science even through all of this. I can never remember. But basically, it's like, think of it as, you know, your mm-hmm. hypervigilance. It right. calms down that part of the brain. And it's like, yeah. And trauma therapies are all about opening this window of tolerance. Let me talk about ketamine again. Because I was working with pain doctors, and I still am, for people who, you know, opioids are fine, like I said, and are needed in some cases, but we can all agree they're not the best treatment. If only because mm-hmm. you're using them, you're going to get them cut off eventually. That's the only reason. Like, otherwise, you know, there's a guy who takes 4 a day and he can walk and be with his grandchildren, and without it, he can't. And what's the risk versus, I'd rather have my grandfather doing that than not being able to live. Mm-hmm. Ketamine is a dissociative. And what that means is, when you're given ketamine, you don't feel your body. So it's like you may have heard, like, the K-hole. It's like you're in a hole. And so you can't feel the pain you're in.
Yes, it does.
So it makes a disconnect. And that's the way it acts. And there are protocols. And it's the Wild West out there to some degree. But there are protocols on how much to give. And this many infusions can help with those types of pain. Like I said, that costs money, though. The FDA is about to legalize MMDA, and I work with a woman who works with MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. I'm going to keep having to say big words.
Yes.
But we are getting trained in how to do this therapy, and we are just waiting for it to start. That's part of the clinic. I'm trying to help with all these latest and greatest treatments, as well as advocate for working with doctors. And by working with doctors, they're learning about these treatments. And there are other ones. There's, there's diet, of course, for inflammation. There's cannabis, which I have found personally helpful. Biofeedback, all kinds of trauma therapies, EMDR, cognitive processing therapy. What do they all have in common? What they have in common is we're trying to get our parasympathetic nervous system engaged. And sometimes you could have told me to breathe all you wanted 10 years ago, and I would have told you to get out of town, because if I could have breathed away that pain, I would have. But as therapists, like I said, we don't like that. We don't know what to do. And so we're looking for people who understand it. It's really hard to understand unless you've been through it. It's hard to be a therapist for someone with chronic pain. It really is. Like a lot of what I hear from my patients is that they understand that I understand, because they experience blame and, well, you know, you're eating terribly. I remember, you know, in the throes of it, I was, you know, at this woman's spa day, and at that time it was, you know, fibromyalgia was the diagnosis on top of all of these other things. And I got a Diet Coke, like we were at a spa day. And one of the women said, Diet Coke is bad for your fibromyalgia. And she was sitting there drinking alcohol. And I was ashamed at that time. I felt terrible. I even wrote I wrote a reflection about what would I say to that woman now. I would say, you don't understand. I wish I could relate to what you guys are talking about, but I can't. I'm in pain. And I don't know how to fix it. And I know that these things are important, but when I try it, I'm still in pain. I'm still not treated. I get frustrated. I can't eat well anymore. I'm just like, well, that didn't work. It's just too much. And that's why I try to help patients one thing at a time here. And let's address the biomedical piece. We've got to get that together, because unless you're being treated, you may need a surgery. There may be things you need, and there may be cases for pharmaceuticals, but unfortunately, some of the pharmaceuticals that they use are not necessarily that great. They're not opioids, though. That's their whole focus.
Right, right. Yeah, as I hear you speaking, I definitely, just to kind of summarize, it's a work in progress. You know, it feels to me, as we're talking about it, you know, there's still so much to integrate, so much to research and see and have the foundation and to, you know, collaborate. So I'm happy to hear and see that these things are happening. And, you know, it does take time. And I agree with you. I think, you know, of course, every therapist is not going to have every syndrome, you know, or every disorder that, you know, we treat. But I think at the core, you know, doing the research, listening to your clients, and, you know, for clients and patients that are hearing this too, explaining how you feel, and that we're able to hear you and empathize, I think that is a great starting point. Do you agree?
Yeah, I didn't mean to say I'm the only therapist in the world.
Oh, not at all. No, not at all.
Yeah. No, I didn't mean it in that way. But
yeah,
just the fact that you're having this podcast, asking these questions, I think the next chronic pain patient that walks into your room, I think hopefully you'll have a better idea of things you can suggest, and also some of the feelings they may be having that you heard them say, but, you know, maybe didn't understand. And more importantly, when you're with these clients, have them advocate through the medical system, have them find a therapist, a social worker that can help them.
You know, I can hear your passion. I can hear, you know, how personal this is. And I just want to thank you so much, Tracy, for telling your story, as well as sharing, you know, the experiences that you've had with your clients and the patients that suffer from chronic pain. Because I think it's important, as you said earlier, that we give them a voice, and that everybody has an opportunity to express their experiences and know that there are those of us who are truly listening and want to help.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like when you have chronic pain, you're in this void and nobody understands. And you're the only people that you're talking to also have chronic pain. And it just, and imagine that's one in six of us. That's a lot. And I can't understate just how devastating chronic pain and illness are. They take away your jobs, your friends, your ability to do things. I have had other professionals compare it to torture because you're isolated, you're in pain, and you don't know when it's going to end. This then makes your body wired to feel it more. So even if you didn't have childhood trauma, just got like, you know, broke your back or had something happen, you develop the same things.
Yes, that can be devastating. I agree. Chronic pain can cause a person to feel like they're an outsider looking in. And I've heard it compared to feeling like a prisoner in your own body. That's really tough. So I'm glad you said that. The good news is in all of this that we're listening, we're talking, and we're working on making this invisible pandemic known to others in various ways. My hope is that this talk, like others, will help anyone listening to feel empowered to advocate for themselves and their experiences with chronic pain. Tracy, thank you so much for being on the show. Your experiences and your information is wonderful and priceless, and I look forward to continuing our conversation in the future.
Thank you so much.
The information and advice offered is not intended to treat or diagnose and is not meant to replace any other professional consultation. If you'd like to know more about the San Diego Psychological Association, go to our website at sdpsych.org. That's sdpsych.org. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, take care of yourself and be well.